The Dory Monson Show on Cairo Radio. This is The Big Lead.
David Bozen for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. The Big Lead today relates to, in some ways, although it should not, the big lead of yesterday, and that is the verdict in the Derek Chauvin case, because as the verdict was being read, there was another unrelated police incident where in Columbus, Ohio, a 16-year-old girl, Makai Bryant, was killed by police officers responding to a call from another young girl who said that someone was trying to stab her. When the police arrived, the body cam footage shows that Makai Bryant wielding a knife. She's within striking distance of another young woman, and the police had to make a split-second decision. And yet, when it happened, the media set to set course for charting the same narrative. They have a narrative where, you know, again, in the Derek Chauvin case, there's no indication that somehow George Floyd was targeted because of his race. That, you know, they were called. There's no disputing that. There's behaviors that required a police presence. There's no disputing that. But it became part of a racial narrative across the country. And then when this shooting happened, it was described as police violence immediately. It wasn't described as police rescuing another young black girl from being stabbed. It was police violence. Now, it's a horrible thing when a 16-year-old makes a decision that ends up costing them their lives. You know, even with a knife, you know, I mean, I've had, you know, some relatives get on the wrong side of the law, make some pretty poor decisions and hurt their lives. And but for the grace of God, they could have easily been shot. You know, they did some bad things and then they went on. So, you know, there's plenty of young people that make stupid mistakes and they live to tell the tale. But there's some that don't. You know, I mean, part of brain development is that you don't have the same amount of control. You know, it's the part of your brain that's kind of measuring a response and balancing out, you know, the part of your brain that's angry versus part of your brain that's thinking, you know, it's just not there. It's not ready to roll yet. Not ready for prime time. That's why you get young people kind of responding angrily and not having good check on their emotions. Heck, it's why Romeo and Juliet is what it is, right? You know, because young love, there's nothing like young love, right? There's no passion as great as when you're young because the brain doesn't have the balancing factor there. It just kind of takes it all in, all the emotional part, then jacks that way up without the balancing part. And so you just can't go backwards. It's when you get older, if you're trying to achieve those same feelings again, it doesn't work. But just like there's no love like young love, there's no hate like young hate or no anger like young anger. You know, so the passions get carried away. You have this young girl, for whatever reason, I still don't know based on what I've read. Maybe it's out now, but if it's come out, it must have just come out, about what her motivations were as far as why there is this this person being chased. People keep describing it as a knife fight. I want to because I keep reading about it's a knife fight. But if only one side has a knife, it's not a knife fight. You know, it's not like when you're watching Friday the 13th that you're going, you know, Jason's in a knife fight with that guy. No. You know, Jason's the guy with a hockey mask. He's got a knife, and he's killing somebody. You know, if one person has a knife and the other person doesn't, and the person with the knife is trying to hurt the other person, it's not a knife fight, right? There's a fight involving a knife, but it's not a knife fight. And also, police don't respond to fights with weapons and say, oh, you know what? I didn't realize you know, even if they both had weapons, they wouldn't say, oh, you know what? I didn't realize it was, you know, it was dueling time. I think we'll just take a pause here. If there's a life-threatening moment, you know, the police respond. But the way the media framed it immediately was, this is part of the police violence story, the way a number of activists framed it immediately, including several who one would think would know better, well, and I think they do, but, you know, again, why let a crisis go to waste? Because it fits the political narrative that they want, and it's sad and shameful. But, you know, in the New York Times, for example, in quoting some of the stuff They were quoting a prominent activist tweeting about this issue. And the original tweet, he had written that she was an unarmed girl killed by police officers. And they just got rid of the unarmed part because, you know, they're cleaning up the tweet so that it doesn't look quite so bad. But they still rolled with the narrative that police roll up, they're violent, they're out of control, they just killed this young girl, right? So it's not police rolled up and they saved a young girl. It's police roll up and they kill a young girl. Now, you know, again, there's criticism that they went up there and they didn't take any time. Valerie Jarrett, who's no anonymous Twitter user, ends up posting a tweet on this. And remember, she was the top advisor to President Obama. She's running his foundation at the time, or right now. She's extremely powerful in Democrat circles, and I'm sure she has heavy influence in the Biden administration. Her tweet was, a black teenage girl named Micaiah Bryant was killed because a police officer immediately decided to shoot her multiple times in order to break up a knife fight. Demand accountability. Fight for justice. Hashtag Black Lives Matter. What about the black life that the cop was trying to save? You know, the knife was not a small knife. It was not a nail file. There's a picture of it from the footage there. You know, this idea that the officer, you know, quote unquote, immediately decided, did he have time to sit down and say, all right, pause, time out, let me freeze frame this? You know, there's somebody that is within striking distance where their arm is back and they're approaching violently somebody and they're not listening to you. You know, what do you do? There's no time. You don't get to choose. You know, it's not like the officer can say, everybody time out, I got to think this through. They have to decide, do I save that person or not? You know, you don't know if that person, are they just going to lightly stab them, or are they going to stab them into the liver? Or are they going to, you know, this is a situation in which what looks like an attempted murder is in progress. And yet the police are being criticized as, you know, this is part of the systemic racism. You know, this is the narrative that we want to present. It's absurd, and it should be called out as absurd. And Valerie Jarrett and others, I'm sure Disney would and Lucasfilm would still be willing to do something with this, but it's grotesquely irresponsible, is it not? You know, to keep spreading this kind of disinformation out there in light of the events and the tensions that have occurred, then throwing this out like, hey, look, you know, this is just yet another example of police violence. And she was not alone. Valerie Jarrett was not alone. You know, it was not like there was a lack of commentary about this. I think it was National Review pointed out the Washington Post, Radley Balko, showed some integrity because he retracted his initial comments, apologizing for not waiting until he knew more. That's a rare quality in today's social media. And the guy, he deserves to be called out on that. Let's see, Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown plowed ahead instead, saying, quote, while the verdict was being read in the Derek Chauvin trial, Columbus police shot and killed a 16-year-old girl. Her name was Micaiah Bryant. She should be alive right now. You know, again, the implication there is just, well, police decided to just shoot this poor young gal. Never mind about the other young, poor young gal who was cringing, about to be stabbed with a knife, from the looks of things. You know, let's not describe that part of the story because it's not relevant to our narrative here. Activist Bree Newsom suggested the cops who were called to the scene should have stayed out and just let the knife fight continue. Quote, teenagers have been having fights, including fights involving knives, for eons. We do not need police to address these situations by showing up to the scene and using a weapon against one of the teenagers. Y'all need help. I mean that sincerely. This is at Bree Newsom, whose headline is Defund and Abolish Police, Refund Our Communities. You know, so I don't know about you. I didn't have too many knife fights as a kid. You know, I did have someone pull a knife on me at one point, but, you know, I don't recall ever pulling a knife. Well, it's not true. I think I was 6 years old, and I had my knife, and I was listening to Secret Agent Man. And I pulled it out of its, it was a dull as a blazes knife. Maybe I was seven or something. This is back in the days when a kid could have a knife to whittle a stick or something, and he didn't panic about it. And I was walking around with it, and a lady looked scared. I can't tell. I never could tell if she was legit scared or if it was, just playing along with me as a kid. But I remember feeling extremely guilty that I thought I might have scared her. That's about it, you know. But again, you know, the idea that police are going to show up, see kids playing with deadly weapons, and they're not playing, they're screaming. One's calling for help, 911, and then they're calling, call up. We're just going to see how this plays out, you know, because activist Bree Newsom says we should just let teenagers be teenagers. So, you know, in the spirit of West Side Story, we're just going to see who ends up dying here and cart them off. I mean, can you imagine? The story then would be police ignore cries for help. I mean, it's just insane, and it should be called out as such. And it's grotesquely irresponsible. And the politicians and others, even they I wish I'd have saved the story where, you know, the quote is, well, you know, we're looking into this. It's a sad situation, you know, and the hint is there's this hedge, this bet hedging where they don't, the politicians involved, they don't want to say, hey, when police are responding, they're going to end up using deadly force. You have to look at what people are doing when police respond. There is individual responsibility. It doesn't mean the officers don't have responsibility, but the individuals have responsibility too. For example, if you're doing something illegal and the police tell you to stop and you try and run off, that your odds of having something bad happen to you with police, they increase, and that's on you. Now, you know, if the police do something wrong, you know, that's on them. You know, that's a problem. Could be a problem in training. Could just be a mistake. But, you know, there's a bigotry, I think, in assuming that people are not responsible for their own decisions when being confronted by police and engaged in any kind of illegal behavior. Now, this particular incident, again, I prefer incidents be judged on their individual merits. This one is just, I mean, just look at the picture there. And you've got the knife out, and you know that officers have a limited amount of time. Remember, if you're 20 feet away, 21 feet away, is like the safety zone where the officer, if you have your gun holstered, you should be able to get your gun out in time and stop a knife-wielding assailant if they're 21 feet away. Not if they're 20 feet away, 21 feet away. You know, that's about the safety zone there. And the young woman appears to be less than 5 feet from the young woman she appears to be about to stab. And, you know, the knife looks to be, looks like 4 or 5 inches there. So it's a significant knife. LeBron James, another individual that maybe Lucasfilm and Disney would still work with, but, you know, not that Gina character from the Star Wars episodes. He was quick to tweet out, quote, "You're next," in all caps, a hashtag accountability with a picture of the police officer, Nicholas Reardon, who is alleged to have shot Bryant. Then he ends up deleting it. So, you know, again, the "you're next," he claims now, you know, he didn't mean this as a threat, but it sounds like a threat to me, does it not? When you're doing an all caps, "you're next," hashtag accountability, what does that mean? Is that a threat to him? Is he saying, maybe at best, he's saying that this officer needs to be charged like Derek Chauvin, which is also absurd and ridiculous. So then he says follow-up tweets, quote, "I'm so bleeping tired of seeing black people killed by police. I took the tweet down because it's being used to create more hate. This isn't about one officer. It's about the entire system. And they always use our words to create more racism. I am so desperate for more accountability." This is just an absurd cop-out. You know, people aren't going to say it because he's a superstar and a lot of business and money depends on him. But look, when he's the one who cited the one individual, the one cop said, quote, "you're next." And then he deletes it and claims that this is about creating hate. Who's creating hate there? You know, the cop was saving another young black woman's life. He's tweeting out something about which he knows nothing. Then he says, it's not about one officer, even though he named one officer. It's about the entire system. So what is the system that you would like to see that would leave a young girl calling 911 because somebody's trying to stab her alone and without the police to help her get out of the stabbing? And then he tweeted out, anger does any of us any good, and that includes myself. Gathering all the facts and educating does, though. My anger still is here for what happened to that little girl. My sympathy for her family, and may justice prevail. You know, again, picture the circumstance and get race out of it. You know, you might be still sad for the family of the young lady who had the knife. I would be. You know, it's, as I said, kids do dumb things. And they get really mad and whatever. But you look at this and you say to yourself, justice isn't prevailed. Like somehow the police are the ones that are responsible. You know, sometimes young people make the bad decisions and they're responsible. You know, parents not, if there's anger issues that haven't been addressed or, you know, they haven't been in control, or there's been no consequences for horrible behavior. But the last person I see on the accountability list here as someone who needs to be lectured is the police officer who now has to live with the sight of a young girl dying at his own hand. And I'm sure it's pretty darn traumatic. Not to mention, you know, superstar celebrities tweeting about, you know, their evil and intent, despite devoid of the context and the circumstances. You know what he's not saying? You know, I just can't believe this. The police shot that girl that was just trying to stab the other young lady. You know, she had her arm raised and she's moving toward her, and there's a 911 call. But still, that police officer really deserves there's no context to it because it doesn't fit the narrative. And, you know, not calling that out, I think, is wretched. So, you know, again, she was Makia Bryant was, you know, had threatened two girls with a knife, according to the New York Times. You know, it's a sad situation because, you know, again, anytime a young person loses their life, you think whatever they were angry about, it could be anything. You just think, you know, give yourself a little bit of time and perspective, and that goes, you know, you learn that you can live. You can move through it. But, you know, the attacks on the officer, the attacks on the system, the attacks on police, it's a horrible, it would be a joke if it weren't so deadly serious and dangerous. And there's a lot of cowardly people and politicians that won't call it out because, you know, it doesn't fit the narrative right now. And I think in some cases, there's the Chris Matthews syndrome where, you know, if you hype up something and you create a scenario in which you're the hero, you know, denouncing various things that are all evil, and you've got this, you know, it's you against the broad system. In many cases, the system that the people who are denouncing it have been in charge of, you know, various politicians have been in charge of the same cities or counties or whatever states for decades, you know, it makes themselves look more heroic. Doesn't mean that they are, but they feel that way, I think. David Bowes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM. David Bowes in for Dory Monson here on 97.3 Cairo FM, and I'm joined by the Center for the Environment Director at Washington Policy Center, Todd Myers, also the author of EcoFads and a number of op-eds in publications statewide and national. Todd, it's Earth Day, and so we know this because numerous headlines have indicated that politicians at federal and state levels have made some pretty grand and sweeping changes that are pro-environment, and they're going to end gas-powered cars within 9 years. And we've got other goals that are usually placed outside of when their elected term will expire, and yet they're getting credit today for various promises. Have you noted yourself any particularly grating promises that have been extolled in the media today?
Well, I think the general promise that we're going to reduce CO2 emissions and meet a target of 50% reduction by 2030, when we have failed to do that over the past several years. Washington State's very unlikely to meet its 2020 target. In fact, King County earlier this year announced a new climate plan. The most recent data show that they were only, in 2018, they were only 4% of their way to the 2020 goal. So they're going to miss badly, but of course, politicians keep promising. We missed our goals on salmon recovery in Puget Sound in Washington. And particularly frustrating is that nobody holds the politicians who make these promises accountable when they come back and fail. They just report the new promises.
Yeah, I mean, I was saying this earlier, and it was a great observation on your part because I learned it from you. They get these promises, they publicize them, they get the headlines that publicize them, and for a lot of politicians, the headlines are currency. I mean, this is the exciting thing. It's not the accomplishment. It's just getting credit for something. And once you get the headline, you get the credit. But as is the case with numerous environmental goals that were published by the current governor of Washington State, when they fail, it's tough to get a headline. It's not like there's a follow-up that says, you know, promises made, promises not kept. You know, here's the big headline. It might be mentioned, but even then, it's a big if. And you've pointed out that what our governor has done in the past is just scrubbed old goals and replaced them with new ones from websites.
Yeah, that's right. So he actually created a system called Results Washington, and Results Washington was supposed to track the results, environmental results, in a number of different areas to hold him accountable. But when he announced he was running for president, suddenly all of those results, not just in the climate area, but in other environmental areas, were suddenly removed from the web page and hidden. And so I asked, hey, you know, where did these go? And they said, oh, we're updating our web page. Well, it took them more than a year to update the web page. And if you go now, they still haven't updated the targets. So the minute accountability, the minute the results don't match the rhetoric, it's not surprising that politicians want to scrub it. What's frustrating is that activists who claim to care about the environment and too often members of the media who are supposed to hold politicians accountable don't do that. Instead, they pat them on the back and say, well, you know, at least you talk a good game. The environment doesn't care whether you talk a good game. It's concerned about results. And that's why we need to connect people, individuals who are on the ground, who have an interest in helping the environment. That's where we're going to get the best environmental results, and that's where we see the best environmental results, not from political promises.
I made the point earlier, I don't know if you heard it, but there was a story in the Smithsonian about these researchers creating a new kind of paint. It's an ultra-white paint that reflects more sunlight and heat, and it actually cools surfaces around it, not just those that are painted. And they think that it could dramatically cut the use of air conditioning in desert climates and other places, and they expect to have it on the market within a year or two. And I was just pointing out that here's another – this is going to be a private business, comes up with a product, and it's going to do more by cutting electricity demand and doing these things that it'll do more for the environment probably than the last seven promises we've heard on the news today on Earth Day to coincide with Earth Day.
Yeah, and it sort of sounds funny that very white paint can do that, but in fact it does. It bounces energy back out into space so that it doesn't stay in the environment, and so it actually does work. Now, how big a difference it makes, well, I don't know. But we focus too often, and we think too often of sort of big, grand results or policy that's what's going to make the difference. When really what you see is the way we make environmental progress is by, lots of small actions that add up to something big. That's the type of environmental problem we have today, is lots of small inputs. And the solutions are going to be distributed small solutions rather than big, grand ideas. Politicians, though, don't like a lot of small solutions. They like big, grand ideas that are, headline grabbing and things like that, even though that typically is not what works. And that's why political solutions are so misaligned from the type of environmental problems that we have today. And that is why innovation and personal incentives and personal activities in a free market are more suited to the types of environmental challenges we face today.
So it reminds me of my daughter was was with me, and we were driving through Seattle, and she'd watched either Rescue Bots or Paw Patrol or something recently, and it was a anti-litter cartoon, and so she's been real hot on anybody throwing anything on the ground, you know, not to be tolerated, no littering. And we're driving through Seattle, and she saw some of the encampments there with trash everywhere, and she said, "Dad, somebody's littering everywhere there, you know, that's naughty, it's got to be stopped." And I said, "Well, you're right. You see it, but there's a lot of adults that seem to miss that somehow." Back to the big headlines of today, Todd. The state legislature is seeking to ban gasoline and any sale of new gasoline-powered cars within, 9 years here in Washington State. It's gotten a lot of play today. I'd like to get your view on that.
Well, back in 2002, California pledged that they were going to create a highway across the state. And then after 2004, Oregon and British Columbia and Washington all joined so that you could drive a hydrogen car all the way from Los Angeles to the Olympics in Vancouver in 2010. And they were going to create a hydrogen highway that was going to have hydrogen filling stations at distances that could allow you to drive that car. Of course, we don't have a hydrogen highway, and we don't even have hydrogen cars. Ironically, Washington State has just passed a tax credit for hydrogen vehicles, which sell for a minimum of $58,000. It's very difficult to predict the future and the technologies, and we've failed again and again. Now, electric vehicles exist, so 2030 doesn't seem like it's too crazy to say that we should have all electric vehicles or only sell electric vehicles. But that's a massive amount of cars, and the fact that we have failed so repeatedly to predict that shows that politicians, rather than choosing the technologies that sound cool today, should give general incentives or more, you know, individual incentives so that the technology can go where it needs to go. And things that we've never thought of today, which are available in 10 years, may emerge. That is what has worked. No politician knew what a hybrid was in the year 2000. They were still focusing on electric vehicles, but the hybrid and the Prius became the symbol of the environmental community because it was the technology that was available. So we need more flexibility, less top-down approach, more innovation.
That just reminds me of, you know, you have a lot of people driving old sedans and stuff that might get 20, 25 miles a gallon. You know, and here's the government steps in. Let's subsidize a $58,000 car. Well, people who can afford a $58,000 car are already driving new cars in all likelihood. They're not people that are driving old sedans, the gas guzzlers, and the rest. You know, so that person who might switch to, say, a super cheap $4,000 refitted Geo Metro is not going to get any help. But the person who's driving, you know, some BMW is going to get a subsidy for their new hydrogen car at $60,000, the year's salary for the person, you know, who's driving one of the beaters. It's amazing that the same group of individuals is no doubt talking about, you know, the lack of progressive taxation in the state, or, you know, they're making lip service toward the plight of the poor when it comes to taxes, and yet they're making these kinds of arrangements. Let's talk briefly about. Go ahead, Todd. You had a comment.
I was
going
to say it's even funnier than that, because oftentimes, what you will hear is that these installations and electric vehicles and other things like that will help the economy. And so I asked an economist one time, "Well, why is that?" And he says, "Well, the rich will save money, and they'll use that money to put into the economy." Because the tax credit will go to other places in the economy. And I said, "But isn't that trickle down economics?" And they said, "Well, yeah." So I think it's very funny that people, you know, on the left who complain about trickle down economics, when they can use it as an argument to, you know, subsidize electric vehicles for the wealthy, they're happy to make that argument.
It's crazy. And it's very frustrating to watch. I used to drive Geo Metros all the time because I'm cheap, and I love the fact that I could get 40 to 50 miles to the gallon in those babies, and that was way back in the day. They died out because there's too many add-ons on the cars. Everybody always wants to add some new requirement You know, and it takes a toll. So I heard a news clip earlier today, and I want to say it was the low carbon fuel standard, but I could be wrong. So I give the governor credit there. But the governor was saying, hey, look, the legislature is poised to implement this new package, and I've still got a lot of hopes for it. And I just want you to know that there's other states like Oregon and California who've implemented this, and their gas prices didn't go up. And, of course, immediately the Bolshevik detector goes off, because if you're trying to curtail behavior, right, driving and use of fossil fuels, and then you're saying, but my program to do that doesn't actually add cost to it, you know, that's not generally how you curb someone's behavior. Say, look, I'm going to put in a new rule, but it's not going to cost you a dime. You know, so what's the reality, and where are we at with the low carbon fuel standard or a carbon tax?
Well, the first thing is that the governor and other folks in the environmental left openly say they want gas prices to go up. So when they say, don't worry, gas prices won't go up, it contradicts the things that they say to their own friends and others, often very publicly. But the second is that it's just simply not true. When California, for instance, adopted the low carbon fuel standard, which is basically a requirement to blend biofuels and subsidize electric vehicles, their gas prices were 20 cents a gallon higher than the national average. Today, a decade after having the low carbon fuel standard, they are 80 cents higher than the national average. So they have, you know, diverged from the national average by 60 cents over the last decade. Everybody acknowledges, including the state of Oregon, the state of California, the British Columbia, the other places that have this system, that it drives up prices. This is not controversial, except among politicians who want to promise you, no, 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 don't worry, it won't cost anything. There is a reason that the biofuel companies are actively lobbying for this in Washington state. It's because it is extremely lucrative to them. They get a lot of money. So it does cost more. Now, you might say, okay, that's fine. We need to pay something to help the environment. So, you know, some people will say, okay, great, it costs more, but it's worth it. The fact is, it's not worth it. It costs 20 times as much to reduce CO2 using a low-carbon fuel standard as other better alternatives that are commonly available. So not only does it increase costs a lot, it wastes 95% of the money that it costs and does nothing for the environment. So it's just a bad thing all around, but politicians can reward special interests, so they like it.
All right, and that's been very frustrating for me, especially the part where you find out all these costs are going to go up, and there's very little environmental benefit, plus you also don't get the benefit of better roads or bridges or maintenance or anything else. It's just cost to the consumer. That's it. And payoffs for friends. Real quickly, Todd, one of the top environmental stories of the year, according to the Seattle Times, was their own Linda Mapes and her speaking to the salmon people, the Lower Snake River tribes and the Native Americans, the Nez Perce, the salmon people. She says, hey, they've had a long fight to take down these Lower Snake River dams to save the salmon. And I remember when the story came out, you said, wait a second, the data here is being cherry-picked. In a nutshell, what happened with that story, and why should it not be on the Times list of top environmental stories of the year?
Well, the Seattle Times included a graphic that said that the salmon are headed toward extinction that stopped in 2019. Well, the story was published earlier this year. The data for 2020 were available. They just chose not to include them because the 2020 salmon populations increased. And they're actually, although it's very early, they're doing better in 2021 than they did in 2020. So they ignored the most recent data because it didn't tell the story they wanted. But the fact is that, you know, a lot of people on the center right are very skeptical of Earth Day. They shouldn't be. Everybody cares about the environment. And if you look at a map of Washington State and you see where people on the center right generally live, they live in forests, they live in agriculture, they live near the environment. We shouldn't make the environment is not a political, it's not a partisan issue, but unfortunately it gets used that way, and I think that undermines our ability to help the environment.
Todd Myers, Center for the Environment Director, Washington Policy Center, thanks so much for your time. David Bowes here on The Dory Monson Show.
My
I think we're out of time for awesome audio, but I do want to share this great story, which is awesome in itself in some ways. If you get frustrated with the Employment Security Department in Washington State, and you think, oh gosh, we lost, what was it, between $500 million and $1 billion, we're just not sure how much yet, depends on if you trust the auditor or not. In Italy, they're having a problem with people not showing up for work. For example, one individual didn't show up for work for 15 years. 67-year-old now faces charges of abuse of office, forgery, and aggravated extortion. But he was a hospital employee who threatened his director for reporting his absence back in 2005. But he's been getting paid ever since. David Bowe is in for Dory Monson. Have a great evening here on 97.3 Cairo FM.
You did good, man. You didn't hesitate.
That's what she said.
Yeah, that is what she said. It works there.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. You're really a fantastic audience.